They met in a distinguished, high-priced restaurant, much too distinguished and high-priced ever to be mentioned in the gossip columns. Not the kind of place which James Taggart, always eager for personal publicity, was in the habit of patronizing. He did not want them to be seen together, she concluded. The half-hint of half-secret amusement remained on her face while she listened to him talking about their friends, the theater, and the weather, carefully building for himself the protection of the unimportant. She sat gracefully, not quite straight, as if she were leaning back, enjoying the futility of his performance and the fact that he had to stage it for her benefit. She waited with patient curiosity to discover his purpose. "I do think that you deserve a pat on the back or a medal or something, Jim," she said, "for being remarkably cheerful in spite of all the messy trouble you're having. Didn't you just close the best branch of your railroad?"
"Oh, it's only a slight financial setback, nothing more. One has to expect retrenchments at a time like this. Considering the general state of the country, we're doing quite well, better than the rest of them."
He added, shrugging,
"Besides, it's a matter of opinion whether the Rio Norte line was our best branch. It is only my sister who thought so. It was her pet project."
She caught the tone of pleasure, blurring the drawl of his syllables. She smiled and said,
"I see."
Looking up at her from under his lowered forehead, as if stressing that he expected her to understand, Taggart asked,
"How is he taking it?"
"Who?" She understood quite well.
"Your husband?"
"Taking what?"
"The closing of that line."
She smiled gaily.
"Your guess is as good as mine, Jim. And mine is very good indeed."
"What do you mean?"
"You know how he would take it, just as you know how your sister is taking it. So your cloud has a double silver lining, hasn't it?"
"What has he been saying in the last few days?"
"He's been away in Colorado for over a week, so I..."
She stopped. She had started answering lightly, but she noticed that Taggart's question had been too specific, while his tone had been too casual, and she realized that he had struck the first note leading toward the purpose of the luncheon. She paused for the briefest instant, then finished still more lightly.
"So I wouldn't know. But he's coming back any day now."
"Would you say that his attitude is still what one might call recalcitrant?"
"Why, Jim, that would be an understatement."
It was to be hoped that events had perhaps taught him the wisdom of a mellower approach. It amused her to keep him in doubt about her understanding.
"Oh, yes," she said innocently. "It would be wonderful if anything could ever make him change.
He is making things exceedingly hard for himself. He always has. But events have a way of beating us all into a more pliable frame of mind sooner or later.
I've heard many characteristics ascribed to him, but pliable has never been one of them."
"Well, things change, and people change with them. After all, it is a law of nature that animals must adapt themselves to their background. And I might add that adaptability is the one characteristic most stringently required at present by laws other than those of nature. We're in for a very difficult time, and I would hate to see you suffer the consequences of his intransigent attitude. I would hate, as your friend, to see you in the kind of danger he's headed for unless he learns to cooperate."
"How sweet of you, Jim," she said sweetly.
He was doling his sentences out with cautious slowness, balancing himself between word and intonation to hit the right degree of semi-clarity. He wanted her to understand, but he did not want her to understand fully, explicitly, down to the root, since the essence of that modern language which he had learned to speak expertly was never to let oneself or others understand anything down to the root. He had not needed many words to understand Mr. Weatherby. On his last trip to Washington, he had pleaded with Mr. Weatherby that a cut in the rates of the railroads would be a death blow. The wage raises had been granted, but the demands for the cut in rates were still heard in the press, and Taggart had known what it meant if Mr. Mooch still permitted them to be heard. He had known that the knife was still poised at his throat. Mr. Weatherby had not answered his pleas, but had said in a tone of idly irrelevant speculation, "Wesley has so many tough problems. If he is to give everybody a breathing spell, financially speaking, he's got to put into operation a certain emergency program, of which you have some inkling. But you know what hell the unprogressive elements of the country would raise about it. A man like Reardon, for instance. We don't want any more stunts of the sort he's liable to pull. Wesley would give a lot for somebody who could keep Reardon in line. But I guess that's something nobody can deliver, though I may be wrong. You may know better, Jim, since Reardon is a sort of friend of yours who comes to your parties and all that. Looking at Lillian across the table, Taggart said, "Friendship, I find, is the most valuable thing in life, and I would be amiss if I didn't give you proof of mine." "But I've never doubted it." He lowered his voice to the tone of an ominous warning. "I think I should tell you, as a favor to a friend, although it's confidential, that your husband's attitude is being discussed in high places. Very high places. I'm sure you know what I mean." This was why he hated Lillian Reardon, thought Taggart. She knew the game, but she played it with unexpected variations of her own. It was against all rules to look at him suddenly, to laugh in his face, and after all those remarks showing that she understood too little, to say bluntly, showing that she understood too much, "Why, darling, of course I know what you mean. You mean that the purpose of this very excellent luncheon was not a favor you wanted to do me, but a favor you wanted to get from me. You mean that it's you who are in danger, and could use that favor to great advantage for a trade in high places. And you mean that you are reminding me of my promise to deliver the goods." "The sort of performance he put on at his trial was hardly what I'd call delivering the goods," he said angrily. "It wasn't what you had led me to expect." "Oh, my, no, it wasn't," she said placidly. "It certainly wasn't. But, darling, did you expect me not to know that after that performance of his, he wouldn't be very popular in high places? Did you really think you had to tell me that as a confidential favor?"
"But it's true. I heard him discussed, so I thought I'd tell you."
"I'm sure it's true. I know that they would be discussing him. I know also that if there were anything they could do to him, they would have done it right after his trial. My, would they have been glad to do it. So I know that he's the only one among you who is in no danger whatever at the moment. I know that it's they who are afraid of him. Do you see how well I understand what you mean, darling?"
"Well, if you think you do, I must say that for my part I don't understand you at all. I don't know what it is that you're doing."
"Why, I'm just setting things straight, so that you'll know that I know how much you need me. And now that it's straight, I'll tell you the truth in my turn. I didn't double-cross you. I merely failed. His performance at the trial, I didn't expect it any more than you did. Less. I had good reason not to expect it. But something went wrong. I don't know what it was. I am trying to find out. When I do, I will keep my promise. Then you'll be free to take full credit for it and to tell your friends in high places that it's you who've disarmed him."
"Lillian," he said nervously, "I meant it when I said that I was anxious to give you proof of my friendship. So if there's anything I can do for..." She laughed.
"There isn't. I know you meant it. But there's nothing you can do for me, no favor of any kind, no trade. I'm a truly non-commercial person. I want nothing in return. Tough luck, Jim. You'll just have to remain at my mercy."
"But then why should you want to do it at all? What are you getting out of it?"
She leaned back, smiling. "This lunch. Just seeing you here. Just knowing that you had to come to me." An angry spark flashed in Taggart's veiled eyes. Then his eyelids narrowed slowly, and he too leaned back in his chair, his face relaxing to a faint look of mockery and satisfaction. Even from within that unstated, unnamed, undefined muck, which represented his code of values, he was able to realize which one of them was the more dependent on the other, and the more contemptible. When they parted at the door of the restaurant, she went to Reardon's suite at the Wayne Falkland Hotel, where she stayed occasionally in his absence. She paced the room for about half an hour, in a leisurely manner of reflection. Then she picked up the telephone with a smoothly casual gesture, but with the purposeful air of a decision reached. She called Reardon's office at the Mills and asked Miss Ives when she expected him to return. "Mr. Reardon will be in New York tomorrow, arriving on the Comet, Mrs. Reardon," said Miss Ives, clear, courteous voice. "Tomorrow, that's wonderful. Miss Ives, would you do me a favor? Would you call Gertrude at the house and tell her not to expect me for dinner? I'm staying in New York overnight." She hung up, glanced at her watch, and called the florist of the Wayne Falkland.
"This is Mrs. Henry Reardon," she said. "I should like to have 2 dozen roses delivered to Mr. Reardon's drawing room aboard the Comet." "Yes, today, this afternoon, when the Comet reaches Chicago." "No, without any card. Just the flowers." "Thank you ever so much."